Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, this is episode number 79 of the Free Cities Podcast. Well, with the beautiful May weather still rallying here outside, I would very much like to welcome you to our latest and greatest interview from the world of free cities. And this week, once again, we are back in the UAE with another excellent conversation from our recent SEZ filming trip. That's Special Economic Zones, if you haven't been listening recently. Krista Fox has an extremely long and illustrious business career. I won't divulge too much, but the important part for us was her six-year position as Executive Director of Dubai's DMCC, which is the Dubai Multi-Commodities Centre, a very well-known and hugely successful free zone in Dubai. As a consequence of this experience, Krista has a lot to say about free zones and what it is that makes them tick. She is also a wealth of information on the past and the present of zones, with many examples and predictions for the future, especially with regard to their residential component, which is obviously something that we here at the Free Cities Foundation are extremely interested in. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the conversation. I certainly did. And don't forget to keep sending your suggestions for interviewees for my upcoming Czech Republic / Liberland trip in a couple of weeks. And of course, I'll always plug the Free Cities Telegram channel if you're after the latest chatter from the wider community of builders and enthusiasts. And something else I will always tell you every week, and this week is no different, please just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Krista Fox. Why don't I? Do you know much about the rise of special economic zones in the first instance?
Yeah.
I think so. Well, tell me what you know. I mean, like, obviously, we could go back into antiquity. The city of London is a, but we're obviously more interested in the contemporary manifestations of them. So, what do you know about the history of special economic zones?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually quite fascinated by the history of it, and you know, if you go all the way back to the Silk Route, and don't worry, I won't stay there for long. But, you know, if you go all the way back to the Silk Route and you think about the sort of encouragement of trade along the Silk Route, and, you know, over time, certain traders were able to secure themselves better arrangements. And then, you know, fast forward to the rise of business and the rise of corporate entities, and think about, you know, how did organizations grow? They started local, and then they started to say, well, how can we sell product elsewhere through export? Then what's the next sort of phase of maturity beyond export? It's licensing and getting a distributor or even having some form of franchise arrangements. And then you start to get to, let's actually set up an entity in a foreign country. So now step across to the governments of those foreign countries, and they're looking at how do we grow our economies. And in 1959, Shannon Free Zone in Ireland was the very first to say, we think we can set up infrastructure, logistics, attract, you know, industrial manufacturing companies to work on our shores and contribute to our economy, and of course still benefit the local economy that company came from. And that was sort of the birth really of the first economic zones. Then we had Jebel Ali in 1985, followed by, in the UAE, followed by Hamriya zone, followed by DAFSA, airport free zone. Those zones were really characterized by being, you know, ports, seaports, airports, logistics focused. Somewhere then along the lines, we said, well, how can we take this model and go beyond it being logistics and customs focused? And we had the birth of Internet City, Media City, DMCC in 2002 focused on trade. And it really grew from there. And those zones began to attract big companies and they began to contribute to the GDP of the country. And so there was a great appetite to see how could we go beyond that and grow more and innovate more and attract more companies.
Can I ask you how long you've been working in and around Dubai?
18 years.
18 years. Mm. When you first came here, what was physically even, what did it look like? Was it already somewhat progressed along its journey to what we see here now?
Yeah, I mean, you see these sort of time-lapse videos and it's so fascinating to see this city has been born, you know, out of the desert, out of the sand. When I arrived 18 years ago, there was definitely sort of business and industry, but it was sort of centered much more toward the creek, which is the old parts of Dubai. And anyone who was, you know, 15, 20 kilometers out of Dubai, which is where we are right now, would find very little. It was a construction zone. We're now sitting in the DMCC free zone, Dubai Multi-Commodity Centre, that has more than 100,000 people, you know, working within 200 hectares. I think there are some 70 buildings in this zone that 18 years ago didn't even exist. And, you know, if you could see to my left, you would find Dubai Marina that has hundreds of buildings with hundreds of thousands of people living and working there. So it's an absolutely remarkable story of development and build and they will come. Not just build and they will come, create the regulatory infrastructure and ease of doing business and a great social community environment for families, and they will come.
You started answering my next question, but it was in describing this place and how much it's evolved in the last 18 years. What is it about a special economic zone that what are the sort of like important ingredients to attract all that talent? Because it's talent as well, isn't it? I mean, you're trying to attract human talent. Obviously, I know what the obvious ones are, but have you got any insights into what else it might be that allows you to create this kind of place?
Yeah, I think I have a very different point of view about what makes an economic zone successful. And that was, you know, I developed that organically. I started as the executive director of the DMCC back in 2012, frankly knowing nothing about economic zones. But something I knew was that authentically what I wanted to do was support the companies that had already chosen the zone. I had this feeling that it was really important to sort of honour their choice and to make sure that if an economic zone attracted a company from foreign shores, that they delivered on the promise. So there are a lot of promises that economic zones make, tax incentives, sort of ease of customs corridors in certain cases, not restricting the ability to hire foreign workers, you know, the ability to repatriate capital and good infrastructure, and I'll come back to that. But those things are kind of hygiene factors. Every zone globally says exactly that. So what can you do to go beyond? For me, the first thing is to get to know the companies that are already in the zone and talk to them, you know, have proper conversations with them, find out what are they trying to do with their businesses. How can you then, as a zone, enable them to grow organically? There are a lot of stories of companies that started in one economic zone and discovered very quickly that they outgrew that zone. That is painful. They outgrew it either because now there was no physical infrastructure suitable for that business, or the company wanted to grow in a particular direction with its business activities that that zone was unable to regulate. And that's a problem. So we began having conversations with investors about what do you want today, but more importantly, what do you want? What's your vision for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years? Not many zones, if any, were having those kinds of really deep conversations. Then we started to get into the room, other partners who could support them along the way, whether it was developers, you know, whether it was others with expertise. So for example, one of the things that we spent a lot of time doing in the DMCC was identifying expert partners. Astrolabs would be one of my proudest examples of this. A tech hub set up and run by two really impressive entrepreneurs who had gone through that startup phase themselves and were able to really smooth the path for other companies that weren't just tech innovators, but were businesses that wanted to use technology as an enabler. And we learned as we went along, and we recognised this is a really important strategy to form strategic alliances with others who have expertise to support businesses along the entire value chain from start to finish. We didn't have to have all that expertise ourselves. We just had to make sure we formed those kinds of alliances. So that for me is the big differentiator, that economic zones can employ above and beyond these very basic kind of offerings that almost every zone is providing globally.
Do you think those initial offerings, though, are they, you know, ideas and needs, are they still valid now?
Absolutely. You
know, yes.
Yeah. To me, it's about deeply understanding what do these business leaders need and having proper conversations with them. And sometimes it's, you know, access for their people in and out of the building. It's really simple things. Other times it's introductions to someone who has influence in their industry. So above and beyond putting on a networking event, it's going past that and curating an introduction to somebody in the industry and going along to that meeting and helping to secure the pathway to enable a deal to happen. And in a way, you know, this is... It's kind of a dichotomy, isn't it, that the model of economic zones is one of regulator and enabler. And I think a lot of zone leaders struggle a little bit with that, because here we are attracting businesses but also making sure they do the right thing. So, you know, any zone leader who is watching this, you know, my advice would be make sure you have those Chinese walls in place. Make sure that you are ensuring the companies that come into your zone are compliant and reputable, and ensure that a very seasoned professional is wearing that hat. Now segregate, you're attracting and enabling and facilitating those companies to do better business and getting them introduced within the ecosystem of the country and beyond. Some of the practical examples that I would take from the DMCC days would be things like running the gold conferences, the diamond conferences, on the back of those being so successful, saying, well, let's see what we can do now for the agriculture sort of food industry. Well, now that we've done that and we see that the coffee traders, for example, the coffee growers out of Africa struggle to get their product to market. Let's set up a coffee centre and a tea centre and bring together all the players across the value chain, from growing to blending to you know, the experts who know, you know, what fragrances go well together, to packaging, to marketing, to branding, and connect them in with the buying countries and provide this sort of infrastructure hub for them and train them and give them education and provide pro forma contracts to them. So if you're a small player, you're able to operate at the same level of sort of integrity and know-how with the same kind of contracts as a big player, and not fall into the traps of, you know, providing your product without having a contract that ensures you get paid for it, or having a mechanism, and this is another thing that we set in place, a mechanism for arbitration or mediation. Those are the kinds of things that probably happen over time. You can't necessarily put all of those enabling infrastructures in place from day one. But for me, those are the things that allow companies, big and small, to be successful in a zone.
You mentioned earlier that you've been to China. Can I ask why were you in China? What were you there for specifically? Yeah. Just to look around or to actually work on projects in China?
I think it's actually a great question. And the obvious answer is to attract more companies from China. But maybe the less obvious answer is to better understand what Chinese companies really needed, and to also recognise that we are probably never going ourselves to have all of the deep knowledge and expertise to be able to create this really smooth pathway for Chinese companies to come and operate here. So how can we find the right partners to work with who can collaborate with us to do exactly that? And some really simple strategies came out of that. So, for example, one of the things that we did is we found an international law firm that had offices all over China, and that were able to introduce us to companies that, for example, were growing produce in the western region of China, companies that were doing amazingly impressive things like chint, creating switching devices and meters for the construction industry and selling all over the world. So how could we then provide a pathway for them to be able to come into Dubai and be successful? We said, well, let's start small. Let's create a China business center within the DMCC free zone, where people speak the language, all of the documentation is translated into Chinese. We'll have two employees within the economic zone whose sole job is to work with that business center to make it easy for those companies to get set up and to operate. This is the bit that a lot of zone leaders forget about. It's not just about attracting those companies. Your biggest advocates are the companies that have been successful, not the ones that just started. The companies that have been in the zone for many years and grown and employed more and more people and contributed to GDP, of course, because ultimately, what are most zones trying to do? They're trying to be commercially successful, but because the majority of zones are either government run or government backed, the raison d'etre is to contribute to the economy, to contribute to the vision of the country, the economy and social improvement. And when you've got companies that come in and they employ people, and their employees have families who have children that are now being educated in the country, and they're buying things and they're going on holidays, you're contributing to the GDP.
Did you learn anything specific while you were in China? Did you learn much about China's SEZ journey, let's say, and did and what they learned on that. Mm. Because they, in a way, they pioneered.
They did.
You know, and
the pilot.
Yeah. I mean, what was your takeaway from what happened there?
There's one big resounding takeaway for me from China, and that is infrastructure. So when you visit China and you see the roads and the infrastructure that has been created to enable business to be successful, you say this is a 50-year or a 100-year vision. This is what zones need to be thinking about. How are we going to enable these businesses that we're going to attract to be successful into the future? And anyone who has visited China and kind of been underground and seen the underground infrastructure, the corridors that have been built to enable businesses to be successful for the next 50, 100 years, for me, that's the big factor. And so if I then translate that into how do economic zone leaders ensure success, is to really think about from day one, where do we want to be on day 50? You can't build this massive infrastructure from day one, but what you can do is you can think about how do we phase it out over many years and what kind of infrastructure would our early investors require from us. And if we don't have the funds on day one, how can we co-invest with those investors to provide incentives to them that would enable them to choose to make that kind of investment? I think this is a sort of thing that's happening in Kenya, for example. Konza, Technopolis are looking at those kinds of initiatives where investors would co-invest. They were able to attract university from South Korea to come and co-invest to set up one of the first companies in Konza Technopolis. Atlantis in South Africa is a zone that really impresses me. You know, if I think about what's that connection between China infrastructure and what other zones are doing. Atlantis in South Africa, Clean Labs, you know, what have they done? They've invested in Clean Labs. What's a Clean Lab? A Clean Lab is basically the kind of laboratory infrastructure that a small research and development pharmaceutical company could not afford to set up for themselves. But what if they did it on the sharing economy basis and they attracted multiple companies to come in and use those facilities on, you know, a time lease basis? Now you've got the ability to start really doing amazing things as a company that you couldn't necessarily afford to do without the infrastructure that the economic zone has invested in. That's where my thinking really started to go as a result of spending time in China.
What about the notion that special economic zones offer governments an opportunity to try out things before they roll them out and fail? Because failing on a large scale is...
Unfortunately, a lot do fail.
I'm interested in that. I mean, but I think that's an important part of the process. Mm. I mean, trying and testing. And one of the unique characteristics of a zone is you can try it on a small scale, especially like somewhere like China.
Absolutely.
I mean, China's transformation was so stark. I mean, you can't go from, there's no more extremes to sort of travel from former China to sort of contemporary China.
Mm, so true.
And you couldn't really roll it out. You couldn't just suddenly wake up one morning and say, okay, we're gonna drop some of our sort of socialist ideologies and pick up a few more free market ones.
The most entrepreneurial country in the world, arguably. This question about sort of using economic zones as a way of sort of trialing a model, if you like, a kind of a governmental business model, it opens a lot of important questions. And the first thing I would say is that one has to think very carefully, governments have to think very carefully before they pilot a zone, because what you're doing is you're attracting investors on a basis, you know, a promise of incentives for a certain period of time. a promise of infrastructure and connections for a certain period of time. So the first thing is you have to be committed and willing to carry through on that promise. So if it's for 50 years, it has to be for 50 years. But where the concept of piloting, I think, works very well is that you can ring fence a geographical location. And free zones and economic zones are really, in a way, a foreign country within a country, aren't they, with different regulations that govern them. So geographically, you can create this small sort of boundary pilot, and if it isn't successful, you've limited the damage, if you like, without kind of going and doing a whole scale incentive across an entire country and having to walk back from that. So this is something that KSA, Saudi Arabia, is doing. The first zones that have been announced in Saudi Arabia, Jazan, Ras Al Khair, CST, which is the cloud computing center. I mean, let me take sort of Ras Al Khair and Jazan. Both of those are huge, you know, hundreds of kilometres zones that have identified a small area for their initial special economic zone sort of incentives. So in a way, that really is testing out whether this works without taking a whole-scale decision to apply those incentives across an area that's already operating. The other thing that economic zone leaders need to consider is what's already happening in my base economy. So if there's a certain industry that's already successful in the base economy, do I want to now create an incentive where I have to give away tax revenue to those businesses? So rather the way the pathway, the strategic pathway that governments take, say, let me identify those industries that I want to attract to our shores, where I want to bring in innovation and knowledge, and keep it at those industries to begin with. We can always widen later and limit the kind of the cannibalization, if you like, between the base economy and the special economic zone area. So long answer to a short question, you know, how can we use this concept of pilot? I think you can use it by limiting the zone geographically initially, making sure you follow through on the promise to those companies that you attract, but also starting with certain industries first. And perhaps if we go back to one of my earlier comments, making sure though that those companies that come in also have a growth path, that you're not, you know, in 5 years' time, they're not going to sort of run out of options to organically grow. If I come in and manufacture, I want to trade as well. I also want to be able to service those customers with my professional services and my advisory. These are real stories that I faced in the DMCC, where we attracted companies that were perhaps, you know, providing, they were trading in particular goods. And then they said to us, well, actually, we also want to hire a team because our customers have asked us for our professional and expert support to service their equipment or their machinery on site as well. And you as an economic zone need to make sure that you're able to regulate those activities too.
As you were saying that, I couldn't help think that, and Dubai is a good example of this, and we were talking about this earlier, that Dubai started off with a number of special economic zones, and now, loosely speaking, yeah, the whole place, 40. The whole place is an economic zone.
That's not exactly true.
Really? But I mean, Okay, you're right. But I think people come here thinking it is, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Dubai itself, it's the place to come where all this stuff happens. What I'm wondering is, do you think that was the plan all along. And is that the point of a special economic zone? You create this little oasis of innovation, and then over the years, it just the good stuff seeps out into the rest of the country, and that country then becomes whatever that is.
Gosh, it's a really good point. And maybe there's a perception that Dubai is just one, or the UAE is just one big economic zone. But actually, if you look at the stats, the base economy is still 10 times bigger than all of the economic zones put together. So the base economy is very significant and always has been. And I would argue that the economic zones can learn from innovation in the base economy just as much as the base economy can learn from economic zones. And let me maybe kind of qualify that a little bit. I'm talking specifically about how investors are nurtured, the kind of journey that investors go through in the lifetime of operating a company in a country, whether it's in an economic zone or in the base economy. How are those regulators nurturing that experience? And, you know, perhaps in a minute we can talk about the different kinds of business models that operate within economic zones. And I think I've got some commentary on how I think that works. But would we like to think that this was all one big, incredible plan from the very beginning that has played out exactly as always intended? There was certainly a big vision back in 1985 when Jebel Ali was established. Absolutely, you know, this was a big, bold vision to create one of the biggest seaports in the world and attract companies from all over the world and establish Dubai as a hub for trade and a hub for re-export. So that has absolutely been realised. I think the evolution of other economic zones across the UAE has been more about opportunistically seeing what happened in Jebel Ali and identifying opportunities in other segments to be just as successful but in a different way. Let's have a look at the evolution of the DMCC, because I think it's a really important story in terms of how economic zone leaders can organically evolve their zones and grow their zones. I mean, DMCC had, when I joined in 2012, they had 3,000 companies. When I left in 2019, there were 15,000 companies. And today, I think it's 22,000 companies. When the DMCC started, what they identified is that there was an opportunity in the gold, jewellery, so, you know, diamonds, precious metals and precious stones sector, to create better regulation around that industry and to also provide a home to traders in that industry. And when I say regulation, this is things like provenance on the supply chain. You know, anyone in that industry would be familiar with something called the Kimberley process. And the Kimberley process is about saying we need to ensure across every point from mining to sale that no one is harmed, there's no financing of terrorism, there's no money laundering associated with that supply chain. I mean, a really important regulatory role to undertake. The other thing that they identified is that industry needs infrastructure such as trading in derivatives and currencies. So it's not just about trading the physical product, but it's also, you know, all of the mechanisms around that. And they set up the Dubai Gold and Commodities Exchange here in this zone sitting behind me. And today we're sitting in the office of EER Business Services, which is a corporate services provider that has established many of the companies that are operating in the DMCC today. And what they would say to you is back in that day, most of the companies were commodities traders. Then what happened organically is consultants wanted to work with those organisations. Other businesses saw that there was infrastructure developing in this zone and wanted to be part of it. And so the zone leaders, and this was a strategy that I took up when I joined in 2012, was how do you create an entire ecosystem? How do you create a city within a city that is not just clustered, but diverse? And I used a term, clustered diversification. It's a beautiful strategy. If you deeply support the value chain of one industry, what stops you from then repeating that for multiple industries, which is exactly what we did in the DMCC, and I've seen other zones doing as well. Do it for gold and diamonds. Now look at the agricultural sector. Now look at the technology sector. Now look at how you build an entire ecosystem. Plus, then you say, well, maybe people want to live and work in this zone as well. A lot of country leaders are very focused on industrial zones. They're very focused on one particular industry segment. I have a view that the most successful zones, the DMCC has been named Global Free Zone of the Year for 10 years now, I think six of them while I was there. It's a mixed use zone. It doesn't switch the lights off at 5 p.m. and everybody goes home. It's got the capability to drive revenue and to drive activities 24/7. And I think that's a really important part of understanding the evolution of very successful zones across this region, and something that leaders can really think about in terms of how they formulate their strategies.
What in that case, what would be your best advice to leaders in a country to identify what might be their starting point in a zone?
Yep.
You mentioned here diamonds and gold and stuff, and I remember that actually.
Yep.
Everyone came to Dubai to get gold,
they
didn't they?
Yeah. And they were a bit dubious about it at first, probably.
Well, yeah, I mean, the gold markets, they're still here, right? Mm. There are still places.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, of course.
It's a lot better governed,
right?
I would say, yeah.
But so how does a government or a state or a leader identify that thing? How best to begin? Because
look, it's really all there are two ways of a zone evolving. One is greenfield, and the other is brownfield. So you know, we've got an existing zone that we want to transform and improve. But let me talk about the greenfield scenario. Typically, it starts with a vision, a country level, you know, a national vision. What is the focus of the national vision? And then economic zones are really supporting that national vision. And usually there's two main elements to it. One is sort of economic industrial development, and the other is social development. The you know, the direct impact is on the industrial sort of economic development, and studies that identify the kind of sectors that are missing from the economy, and of course, you know, the infrastructure and sort of geographical location aspects that would enable us then as a country to serve those markets. That's really the starting point to identify industries. And then we start to say, okay, well, if we've got those industries, where today are all of the current players located in that industry value chain, from the producers to the consumers, and what can we do to serve that? And you know, as an example, when we worked in Kenya, one of the things that we identified is that so much of the product that was produced in Kenya and surrounding countries was being immediately exported as raw material to other locations for value add. Well, what would stop us from developing the infrastructure in country to enable that value add to happen in country? And those to me are the kinds of questions that leaders need to be asking themselves about the industry, the addressable market, the industry attractiveness. There's another really important thing that needs to happen very early in the piece, probably two other things actually, very early in the piece. One is, how are we going to work within the boundaries of this country? How are we going to create what we call interoperability with the base economy? If we've got a zone, we need to provide, you know, firefighting services. We need to put in roads. We need to have junctions. We need to have electricity. We need a police force. So in terms of all of those civil services, sometimes it's an afterthought, and zones run into some difficulty determining who's going to do what within the boundaries of the zone. So I would say get those things sorted out pretty quickly. And I've forgotten what the third one was.
It doesn't matter. I've already thought of something else. The third one's fine. I was interested when you...
That's the problem when you say three things, then you've got to remember what those three things were.
I was interested when you mentioned that zones with people actually residing within the zones are... Well, you seem to speak of them as them being the pinnacle of the zone journey at the moment. I don't know.
I'm biased.
Maybe it's not, but can you speak a bit to that in terms of, is the special economic zone evolution? Is it an evolution? Is there a trend? And if so, where are we at now, and where are we going with it?
Yeah. There's a couple of trends, I would say, in economic zones. One of the trends is that it's to work out whether the zone itself lends itself to a mixed use environment, a city within a city that allows people, you know, to live, work, play, get educated all within the one zone, or whether it's that traditional model of, you know, you come through the gates with your gate pass in the morning and you leave in the afternoon and you're surrounded by sort of industry and factories and you really kind of live nowhere near the zone. To me, the trend I'm seeing is that people actually want these mixed use zones. Heavy industry doesn't necessarily lend itself to that. But even if you look at the evolution of a city like King Abdullah Economic City in Saudi Arabia, you know, it's been very capable of creating this ring-fenced area, industrial valley, while also developing an entire mixed-use city around that. So that's one thing I'm seeing. The next thing that was, you know, precipitated but probably anticipated, you know, well before, but precipitated by COVID is that it's a nonsense to do what many zones do, which is to force companies to take a certain amount of physical space for people who are never going to work in the zone. They are remote. They're mobilized at client site, for example. Allow them to run their businesses in the way that is most logical for the business model of that business, and find ways to govern them. Use things like self-assessment for compliance. Use things like risk-based assessment to ensure that these are reputable companies. But don't kid yourself into believing that just because somebody physically has an office that you've now got a better governance arrangement within your zone, because that to me doesn't work. You've got to align yourself with the way businesses actually work. I mean, an example I would say I'm quite proud of from a number of years ago is where we created a strategic alliance with a developer within the UAE. They were building a really fantastic residential tower that had an entire floor dedicated to co-working space. And we said, well, how can we work with you to help you regulate? Because you don't know about regulation, but what you have done is created this wonderful infrastructure that people want. They want to live in this building. They want to have they want to be able to sort of work from home, but in a space where they're interacting with others within a business community. We'll help you to regulate and you build this great infrastructure. We've got to think outside the box. We've got zones that are talking about how do we regulate businesses that are going to be earning their money from outer space. There is no physical infrastructure on this earth to do that. So these are really the zones of the future that are saying, we've got AI, we've got virtual working. How do we make sure these are reputable businesses with good compliance and avoiding at all costs money laundering, financing of terrorism? This is very important in my mind, that we never lose sight in economic zones of ensuring that these are good businesses that do the right thing, that earn their money from proper practices, and that we're attracting and enabling the growth of good companies that contribute to the betterment of the world. That's the direction I think it's taking. Yes, good infrastructure, but also some really innovative thinking about how you regulate businesses that don't actually need any physical infrastructure at all.
What do you think, what's your personal view on autonomy in general? How much is good? Is there a limit? I mean, one day could some of these zones become completely autonomous?
You know? Well, I think some of them kind of pretty much already are. So if you asked me that question of autonomy when I was the exec director of the DMCC Free Zone, I would have said, give me as much autonomy as possible, because we wanted to innovate. And we believed that we had the expertise to do the very best we possibly could for the companies that were coming in. And what I mean by that is there are zones that are the regulator in terms of registering and incorporating companies. They're the licensor, and they're also the owner of all the property infrastructure. So they're leasing out, they're licensing these businesses, and they're incorporating the businesses. And that was really the DMCC. I'll talk a little bit about the licensing in a second. Then there are those zones that in Korea, for example, in Singapore, currently in Saudi as well, although I think that will evolve, where the base economy incorporates the company. So there's still a really big regulatory role being played by the base economy. And the economic zones license the company to operate with certain activities. So your share structure, your incorporation, your sort of LLC status is the base economy, and the licensing is with the zone. The advantage of that, I think, and I really like the Saudi model, is that you can create consistency. What's the big problem with autonomy in the UAE? And this has been sort of the evolution of this very competitive economic zone environment, is that no two pathways for an investor to come into the UAE are the same. It's confusing. And if I want to move from one zone to another, it's a very difficult transfer of incorporation process. I believe that there's a real role to play. Yes, autonomy is great because you can create strategies that enable you to innovate as a zone. But if you're looking at a countrywide policy, create consistency where the process itself doesn't create that much of a value add. Allow the zones to be really autonomous in terms of how they innovate and support and create infrastructure, but the regulatory processes of setting up a company, make them easy and consistent would be my advice.
I mean, when you describe a zone that begins as an economic zone and then starts bringing in lifestyle services, accommodation, you are talking about creating new places, really. What's your view on autonomy in those kind of places, as in more legal autonomy, not just regulatory autonomy, but you know, it's almost like the creation of new places, you know, places that are distinct from the host nation. Yeah, a country within a country. But I mean, do you think that'll ever happen, or do you think, because obviously,
I think you almost, I don't know, I'm not sure that you can actually do it, to be honest, because people are always going to want to have sort of free flow between this zone and the rest of the country. And that raises a lot of tricky questions that zones have to deal with. If I've got a sort of a big city that's operating within a city and it's got its own autonomous regulatory framework, well, now am I going to be the expert regulator of absolutely everything? The dentist, the surgery, the food manufacturing? Maybe I am, or maybe what I say is there's certain expertise that is already well developed in the base economy. Wouldn't it be sensible to form alliances with those base economy regulators and sort of dual regulate, do what we do well, and invite into the regulatory framework other regulators that have expertise in their fields? I think I'm much more in favour of that arrangement, and it's a scale. It's just an economies of scale in my mind question. The evolution of a zone is that you don't have 20,000 companies on day one. So how do you, from a commercial point of view, how do you develop a zone with all the expertise sort of sitting waiting to regulate 5, 10, 15 companies in the first year? That's why I'm much more in favour of this sort of interoperability kind of model, and why when I advise regulators and economic zones globally, I say, let's have a really good look at where do we want to be independent and where do we want to form really good relationships with the base economy. And I think that works much better. And those that don't do it, if I look at my brownfield experience of trying to help zones transform, I think that's where some of the biggest problems occur. We haven't created clarity and you know, cleared up expectations from day one as to who does what between us and the base economy.
What about your view then on the current trajectory, or just seeing at the very sharp end of the wedge of the innovation in special economic zones? Because it is a trend. The economic zone is a trend. And when you think about it, looking at the example of Dubai, it's very much that, you know, they will have to innovate further in the end, because there'll have to be something else.
Yeah.
They've nailed it. They've done it right. They've brought
just more
it.
Of the same.
Well, you could do more of the same, but that's not innovation, is it? And you know, it might lay in the hands of another country to be the innovator. It might be Saudi Arabia, whatever. Yeah. But I get the sense that they will want it to innovate here. Mm. I know that going to Saudi now, you probably innovate better because there's fresher minds looking at, like, well, we don't want to copy Dubai or the Emirates. Mm. So what are we going to do? So, you know, what is the trend? Maybe it stops here. Maybe it does stop here.
I think there's always going to be an element of you can't run someone's business for them. And there is a trend in some zones to get so involved in the business of the investors that are in their zone as to really interfere. So one trend that I would like to see happen is a little bit more of enabling and providing infrastructure, but giving businesses the ability to to flex however they need to follow their business model. And that probably comes back to some of the things I talked about before. If your business is growing because you've got a workforce mobilized around the country or around the world, zones need to think about how they can enable that. If it's important for a business that they've got loyalty and continuity of a workforce, how do you provide that if you've got this system where every 2 years or 3 years, everybody has to get a visa again, or that if as a workforce, if the workforce, you know, has skilled expertise, but those experts might be between opportunities, how do you keep that talent inside the country if you haven't aligned your employment laws and sort of labour laws and immigration rules with this enabling environment of an economic zone? I think these are the kinds of issues that we're still grappling with. You know, we right at the kind of the 50-year mark, we're talking about things like sort of AI and you know, workforces that you know are comprised of androids, but today we've got more basic issues that thwart companies that economic zones haven't necessarily dealt with yet. We've got still piles of paperwork that some zones require investors to fill in, and so for me, I actually tend to look more on that kind of 5 to 10 year horizon. I say, make the processes easy. I've done a lot around digitization of government services. And this is something that not so many zones have cracked the code on, but those that crack the code on making it a very smooth pathway, regardless of whether the service is in the zone or part of the base economy, that there's this one very digitized, easy pathway, no matter what services you require. Those are the things I'm more interested in, to be perfectly honest, than where are we going to be in 50 years' time. I'm more interested in saying, how can I make this a really successful decision for you as an investor today that you don't regret? You've decided to invest 100 million, 200 million, a billion in developing a project. I'm going to get you your municipality permit in 1 day, not 5 weeks or 5 months. This is where I would say, have a look at the ease of doing business report. You know, it's got those sort of, what is it, 10 or 12 elements to it for a reason. Can I get my utility services straight away? That's what I'm going to do. Can I get a municipality or a construction permit without delay? That's what I'm going to help with. Can I get the company set up and incorporated and licensed and employing people quickly? That's what I want to see, because then those business leaders can go and grow their businesses with me enabling that to happen and not waste their time dealing with paperwork. So maybe that doesn't answer the 50-year question, but that's my honest, authentic answer to what I think is important for zones to do.
I agree. We might, your company might be majoritively composed of, like you say, of robots in 50 years. How are you going to do that? Do you even need to? Anyway, one thing I forgot to ask you earlier, actually, was about China. Sorry to jolt back to Shenzhen. I was interested to hear your opinion when you went to see it. Could you just describe it? And how long ago it was, and was it part? Yeah. Was it very far into its journey as a special economic zone? Because I think it's probably the most successful zone in China.
In China, yeah, I think Shanghai is pretty successful.
But would you call that a special economic zone, though?
Well, it's a pilot zone, isn't it?
Which one, Shanghai?
Shanghai.
Is it?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I think of Shanghai as being the city that was, you know, whereas
yeah, but
I think
a
of
pilot
zone
in Shanghai as well.
Right.
So, you know, companies like, I hope I don't get this wrong, but, you know, I visited Shanghai zone. I mean, let me talk about Shenzhen, of course, but You know, the infrastructure in somewhere like Shanghai Zone is also incredible, and they're very focused on how do we enable this sort of, you know, really swift customs clearances, which is very important for a port zone to get right. Shenzhen, or Shenzhen, is just so impressive in terms of the infrastructure. The innovation that you see in a place like Shenzhen is a big surprise. We probably think of China of many years ago, and images pop into our heads, rightly or wrongly, of sort of sweatshops. And you go to a factory in Shenzhen, and what you see is incredible machinery. You see very few people, actually, because it's working in such a digitized way. So, you know, these zones are actually attracting companies that are very much R&D focused, and they're delivering on this promise of high levels of innovation. Not in Shenzhen, but in the west of China. I remember traveling and doing a tour of a truck making facility, a truck manufacturing facility, and they can make a truck in 5 hours. I mean, a whole truck. And so their investment into the infrastructure within that factory facility of these sort of, you know, moving pods and teams of people who are building from the chassis right through to the entire truck was absolutely meticulous engineering. So we should not underestimate the advancements in technology that's happening in zones like Shenzhen, and what the Chinese government is doing to enable that to happen. I think, you know, where we've missed though in this conversation, and it's important to point out, is that not all zones are government run. Many zones are privately run. And this is probably part of the evolution of economic zones as well. We take private groups that have huge amounts of knowledge of trade, of you know, investment, attraction opportunities. They know all of the big companies and what those companies want to invest in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. And they're able to do and identify the site selection. What they're also doing is they're entering into agreements with government for concession. So either I get a plot of land, or I may even, as a concession holder, need to provide some upfront investment, and in return I promise to develop the economy, and I'm making a return from doing that. And the beauty of that arrangement, of course, is that governments have finite budgets. They're able to lock these investors into, and these are big experienced developers, lock these companies into the promise of returns, and they need to fulfill those promises, sort of minimum licensing arrangements, if you like. And then it's in the hands of private enterprise to really make sure that the feasibility study is realised. I think that's a very important evolution of economic zones, and something that will enable the rapid rise in parallel of economic zones globally or within certain countries. As a government, you can only do so much. But as a government, if you regulate and enable private concession holders under the right arrangements, you can actually develop multiple zones at once, and you can select developers that have experience elsewhere.
I think one of the things that we are very interested in the evolution of zones is that you could run a private zone with people living in it. You know, you could have a service provider who basically runs the zone.
Yeah.
And you pay, you sign a contract to live there and you pay the service provider a fee. Yeah. And I think we think that's possibly the next stage in the evolution. I mean, you actually said it well. You said there's a limit to what governments can do on their own, I think. And I think... I don't know. I was very
governments
happy
almost
that.
Need to stand back, don't they? I mean, that's what we did when we found, you know, these incredible business leaders who knew technology like the back of their hand, who'd been through all the pain points, or who knew the, you know, the whole system of sort of wellness and health and that ecosystem. We said the worst thing we could possibly do is actually intervene, because we know just enough to create trouble. What do you need from us? We'll give you the infrastructure, we'll enable the licensing, we'll make sure the right kind of companies come in terms of reputation and compliance. But developing the ecosystem for this industry, that's your expertise. Got to find the right people though. You know, there's a lot of people around who purport to be knowledgeable. So what you've got to be good at as a government, or, you know, or a regulator or a concession holder, is making sure you do the deep dive into their real expertise. What have they actually done? What have they actually delivered? There's a lot of big talk on paper. Do the due diligence on that, and then as much as possible, let them be successful.
Do you have any specific examples of zones that failed and why it was? What is it about a failing zone that gives it, that allows it to fail?
I mean, it's such a good question, and it gives me pause for really thinking about, well, what is it that I think one of being overly ambitious from day one. It's a big investment in to create a zone. So from a master planning point of view, it absolutely needs to be phased. One of the things that I would also say is that the best best developed strategies just don't always tie in with what happens in the market. So there's got to then be the ability to be flexible. And to be flexible requires, I think, two things. One is rezoning. So if you've got autonomy around the zoning of your development, this is quite critical, because then you've got the ability to be flexible about the future phases of the development. And this is the big money goes into the infrastructure of the development. And once you've put in that kind of big money underground, what helps you to realize the investment is the superstructure. So you have to be sure that you've got the investors from day one. Don't build out all of the infrastructure from day one. Plan it out perhaps, but don't build it all out. Create a small area where you've got the right infrastructure and you're able to very rapidly build the superstructure to then realise the revenue, the leasing revenue or sale of land in some cases, and you know, revenue from services. That would be the first thing. The second thing is, you know, why do some zones fail? Because they're just overly ambitious. They spend a lot of money up front. They take a lot of time before they do anything that delivers any inflow of cash. The second thing is they haven't secured the arrangements with their regulations or the base economy. So this really catches zones out. I haven't got a wide enough scope of business activities that I can regulate. Now I can only attract this very narrow addressable market into my zone, and I can't even give them a future pathway to develop organically because I can only regulate, you know, 5 or 10 activities. That to me would be reasons for failure for a lot of zones. And then you're in this, you're among an ecosystem of zones that are already very successful. So, you know, what's your one thing that you can say you're able to do very differently? Because it's not incentives, it's not, you know, customs corridor, it's not repatriation of you know, capital, it's not the employment laws, because everyone does that. So what is the one thing that you can do? Take it back to say, this you know, the Kenyan example that I gave earlier, the one thing that you could do is say, there are all these producers that surround us here. We're going to give you some infrastructure through the sharing economy like they did in Atlantis so that you can leverage value for your businesses and you can do value add in the country and make more profit in the country. I think things like that.
Yeah, I mean, it makes total sense. So, I mean, you're the fourth person we've interviewed and two other people have mentioned the same thing. You know, you're...
Easier said than done, isn't it?
Well, you have to know what the trajectory and the intention of the host country is, and you have to align yourself with that.
Yep.
And find, I mean, I think also one of the unique things you could offer is location as well. I mean, and not even mean, I don't even mean like Dubai is a really good hub. I mean, a beautiful place. I mean, there's, do you know Prospera in Honduras, which is one of the, Prospera's a ZA, one of the zones of economic development. That, and it's a tropical island, basically. And part of the draw, I know they're attracting a lot of cutting edge businesses, mainly.
Coyol like, in Costa Rica is another example.
But that can be a pull. I mean, if you can live and work near a surf break or, you know, whatever, I don't know, whatever your thing is. But each country has to identify what that thing is, I think, maybe. But
For sure, a beautiful place to live, a safe place to live. Somewhere that you want to bring your family, somewhere that has education facilities and good healthcare facilities. Otherwise, you're only ever going to get kind of the one working member of the family who's kind of flying in and flying out. And it probably is part of the evolution, to be honest, of the zones that we see. And I probably come back to the Saudi example a lot, but you know, that's kind of what we're seeing now in Saudi, isn't it? That Saudi is now attracting families, not just the one working member of the family who flies in and flies out. And from a holistic sort of sustainability perspective, developing infrastructure that creates a community, I think that's really important. That is therefore essential, that it's a safe, attractive location, not just within the zone, but outside the boundaries of the zone. That requires a lot of investment in infrastructure, doesn't it? How can you do that? How can you kind of create that in the early days, even if you're in a country where you haven't got all of that roads infrastructure or great communities? You probably have to look at zones that are mixed use, that are boundaried. And, you know, Konza Technopolis would be a great example of that. It's a city. It's a self-contained city. Has it been fully realised yet? No, probably not. But it avoids the traffic of Nairobi. It allows people to live and work and get educated and you know, do everything that you would want to do within a city. Without having to deal with some of the less desirable aspects within the country. Can others do something similar to that? Yeah, I think so. But what about, I mean, Morocco? I mean, the whole set of zones in Morocco, Morocco's done incredible things in terms of development of economic zones, port facilities, industrial zones, all tied together. They have sort of a consistent approach in terms of the umbrella regulations, and at the same time, a lot of new residential development as well. So you can live in a fantastic zone, in, you know, a fantastic residential development in Morocco, you know, Casablanca, I think is the main area, and also work within an SEZ. I was in Lithuania about sort of 3 or 4 months ago, and I met the owner of a business who is in relocation. Actually, it was where we're sitting right now. The office of the company that we're sitting in right now is a corporate services provider, an immigration provider, and a relocation provider. And as part of one of their conferences, I met a relocation provider who had moved the entire business from Europe, Germany, to Morocco, because they loved the residential environment and they could set up their business there and operate from there successfully from the economic zone. That's a great story, isn't it? And, you know, 10 years ago, would a company have said, you know what, I'm going to move from Germany to Morocco? Maybe not. Quite an amazing job.
I mean, I think that's a good example, the Morocco one, of someone, of a country leveraging its cultural, you know, like...
But let's talk about Cairo then. Let's talk about New Cairo. You may have seen the announcements of the Cairo International Financial Center. So that's been announced about 12 months ago. I know there's a lot of sort of work going on there, and perhaps I wouldn't say too much about it. But what's in the public realm there is very interesting. That zone is earmarked to be located within the New Cairo Administrative Center. So what the Egyptian government has done is they've said, we're going to move all of the government ministries from the old part of Cairo City to the new administrative center. This is a beautiful development, very green, beautiful development, mixed use, close enough to the Suez Canal as well. You know, there's the Suez Special Economic Zone. So you might imagine in a zone like that, you've got a financial center, you've got people living and working in government. Private sector is going to crop up. You've also then got the ability very close by to be within a customs corridor and close to the Suez Canal, where you can, you know, trade very easily right across the world. Those are the kinds of strategies that are going to be very, very interesting into the future.
Wow, 100%. It's fascinating. I'm happy to hear of some new. I'm going to go away and look all these places up. I think I'm happy at this point. I'd just like to say thanks. Thanks for speaking. That was a phenomenally interesting conversation.